I'm a little bit early. Not many people. Any comments or questions from previous week, previous session? I think perfectly clear. Always it must be so clear that there's absolutely no doubt at all. I'm just joking. There is a practice in Tibetan Buddhist tradition. There's actually a set of practice where sometimes it's called preliminary practices, which involve repeating certain actions or certain activities 100,000 times. And so one of those is to offer 100,000 water bowls. And another one is very strenuous one, 100,000 prostrations. You don't do it in one day, or you do it over a period of time. In the Gelug tradition, which this center belongs, you need to do it continuously. There's no break in between. Otherwise, you start from zero again. And so, the people will commit to finishing that 100,000 of prostrations or making water bowls, offering, sometimes involve reciting certain mantras 100,000 times. And one of them is to repeat what we call the refuge formula. Means practice going for refuge 100,000 times. So there are different formulas, different verses people repeat. The simplest one is, I go for refuge to the Buddha, I go for refuge to the Dharma, I go for refuge to the Sangha. So that three count as one, right? And you repeat it 100,000 times. Of course, it's not that simple. In Tibetan Buddhist tradition, they always ask you to visualize this and visualize that. And so you do the whole thing. And many, many years ago, when I was still young and very enthusiastic, I commit myself to doing this practice of 100,000. So you must remember, you cannot have a break in between, right? Otherwise, you start counting all over again. So I was working back then. So there are good days, and then so I will do a proper session, spend some time, recite, you try to recite as many as possible in one session. Then there are also other days, maybe very busy, or went out for to watch movies or whatever, and then I arrive home really late, and all I can think about is to sleep. I cannot break the continuity of the practice, otherwise I have to start all over again. So I will try to do it at a breakneck speed. Usually there is this recitation, you recite the visualization, you recite it, and then you come to the point where you go for refuge. So I do the minimum three. Okay, now I dedicate. I fall asleep. So that's how I completed my preliminary practices of reciting 100,000 repetitions of that formula. The practice is a very interesting one. Because it's so long, it takes such a long time over so many days. It's very helpful because you get to see yourself or experience yourself in different conditions, different circumstances. There are days where you are very devoted and concentrated and really, try to put your best into the practice. Then there are other days where all you want to do is to get it over so that you can sleep. Yeah. And so in a way, it's like a snapshot of life itself. That in our life, we have a lot of different experiences. And confronted by all those different experiences, how can we find the sense of refuge under those different circumstances? Yeah, and that is also true for other types of practice within this category, like prostrations. There are days you feel very inspired and you do prostration. There are also other days you don't really feel like doing it. Yeah, and so the requirement of the practice that asking you to commit yourself to a daily practice until you finish the number. So I'll create a condition where you really see how you yourself can come back to the practice on the good days and on the bad days. You also see how practice can impact you, when you're feeling good or you're feeling bad. And over time, the practice becomes a support for you that you can return to again and again, on good days, on bad days, on days you feel like doing practice or you really don't want to do the practice. So there is a practice of commitment to it. And out of that, you may discover for yourself how these different practices can support you and can become, like for example in the case of going for refuge, actually become a refuge for you. So that you can come back to it and derive some strength, some support from it, during good times and during bad times. Okay? So really the essence of this topic we are now going through about refuge is about we ourselves finding our own refuge. Something that is we entrust ourselves to replace our heartfelt trust on. And in turn is able to support us, in turn is able to provide a kind of a sense of safety and security that really benefit us. So as a more internal process that is supported by external kind of activities. Right? The fact that quite often in Buddhist setting although I usually don't do it, but other teaching setting or when you come for what we call puja, some kind of chanting ceremony, or some people even in their own private practice, they start off by reciting different prayers. And one of the most common ones, or the first one people recite, is the refuge formula, going for refuge to Buddha, to the Dharma, to the Sangha. So you verbalize or mentally you recite in words, in a way, recommitting yourself to the objects of refuge that you have accepted, you have adopted. Yeah. So what we are doing here is to take a look at this whole process of finding refuge and then relying on our refuge. And since the main idea of this series is experiencing the Buddha's teaching, we're asking ourselves, hey, how can we find that sense of trust, so that we actually remember and we come back and go for refuge to these objects of refuge that we have accepted or we have acknowledged for ourselves. So that's the main idea over these few sessions we are looking at. Okay. Right. So last week I mentioned we automatically go for refuge. The difference is what are the objects of refuge that we rely on. Right? So some of us rely on comfort eating. Comfort eating is a refuge for quite a lot of us. At times of great difficulties, a lot of unpleasant emotions, a lot of disturbing thoughts, difficult circumstances, we just eat mindlessly. Comfort eating requires mindless eating, not mindful eating. Okay? Mindless eating. The whole idea is to not pay too much attention to what you eat. You just eat, you eat, you eat. And that activity somehow usually a lot of this activity that we rely on give us some degree of pleasure. Of course we pay a price for it. But that pleasure help us temporarily to divert our attention away from what is distressing, what is difficult, what is very painful and highly unpleasant. So that's why it becomes a temporary refuge. Once you finish your potato chip, right, then you're faced with a double problem. The original problem and the problem that you eat all this junk food and whatever consequences. But while you are in it, it is a kind of refuge. No, not a very good quality one, not a very helpful one, but nonetheless, sometimes in desperate times, a lot of us rely on it. Other people will be addicted to internet surfing, right? In the old days, I used to do what I call channel surfing. That's a little bit like, I'm quite old, pre-internet time, you have cable TV, right? And I used to watch cable TV late into the night. And you, all programs are gone, and all you're left with is telemarketing. They're selling mocks, they're selling don't know what, you know, mattresses, you know, and there's all this presentation, right? So, but I was still channel surf. I thought, okay, finish this mattress and go to the next one. But eventually, maybe a nice program will come on. Usually they don't, they just run reruns in the middle of the night. You know? So, the channel surfing is a meaningless activity, but somehow I find myself engaged in it. So, a lot of activities we do belong to a kind of, in a way, we are seeking refuge. We are seeking a way to protect ourselves from the unpleasant aspects of reality. You know, those aspects of reality we are not ready to face, or we can't face, or we're trying to run away from. So, in the view of that, so in this topic of refuge, we say, what other objects of refuge that are maybe better qualities, more worthy, and are really actually beneficial and not harmful. So we seek out other objects of refuge. Okay. So maybe in your own personal experience, you may find that even when you officially become Buddhist, you go to some official ceremony, or you walk kneeling there for a long time, and then sometimes they give you a cert, they stamp a name on it, yeah, and then you become Buddhist. Then you can tick under the census that I'm Buddhist. And then when you die, maybe you get a Buddhist cremation or ceremony. On this day in Singapore, a bit bobake, it's a mixture of Buddhist and Taoist. My father is never religious, right? He got a Buddhist ceremony plus a little bit of Taoism inside. Because my sister said, must burn the house. So that paper house, the paper car, must burn. Otherwise, for that, don't have anything in the other world, right? So that is not Buddhist. Yeah. Okay, so we re-examine in the case of, from the perspective of Buddhism, what are worthy objects of refuge? And the important thing is not what is been said officially, but what you yourself believe and felt within yourself. Because if you don't accept it, you don't entrust it, those objects of refuge are not very useful. And you find that you tend to forget about them. You come to ABC, and then you open the prayer book. Oh, yes, I'm a Buddhist. That's right. No, I go for refuge to Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. But when you're outside at work, at family, or when you encounter some difficult situation, you may not remember your objects of refuge. Right? So that's not ideal. Right? That's not really what the whole point of it is all about. The whole point is that even when you are not in a very Buddhistic setting, in times of need, this object of refuge comes up to support you, comes up to protect you in a way, and becomes true objects of refuge. And you find safety, you find security, you find support from them. Right? One example is my own example, very minor example. Traveling in India, I didn't go to India many times, but every trip is a colorful thing. One trip, we are going down South India for teaching by the Dalai Lama. So we took a bus. And this bus, in the middle of the night, actually lose the brake. It had no braking function. I think it's almost dawn. Yeah. So I was still awake. You see, I'm those type of people that unfortunately I cannot sleep. I cannot sleep on an airplane. I cannot sleep on most bus, especially when I'm traveling, whereas I'm surrounded with people who are incredibly capable of sleeping. They sleep in all sorts of posture at all times, and even when they arrive at the hotel, they can still sleep. So they're all asleep and awake. And then I find this bus, there's something strange about this bus. It seems to be going faster and faster, and doesn't seem to show any sign of, even then, doesn't slow down. I have this strange feeling that maybe the brakes of the bus is not okay, and it's true. So the only way for the bus driver to stop is to go off the road onto the rough terrain, and use the terrain to, the friction basically to slow down and stop. And spontaneously in my mind, Tara's mantra comes to my mind. because I was also blank, right? Just just basically I'm just praying. I don't know what I'm praying for, but you know, it comes up in the moment of fear, right? And I was so glad that eventually it did stop, right? Stop in the middle of nowhere. So in the end, you know, we still have to continue the journey in the same bus, you know? Yeah. But that moment of fear, the moment of danger, what comes to mind in my case is Tara's mantra. In fact, I have other stories of similar, yeah. And I always find, I was very amazed. I'm not a very, although I like Buddhism, I study a lot. I'm not strictly speaking a very good Buddhist in that sense, yeah. But I don't like all these prayers things, yeah. But I was amazed that in times of need, how amazing that for me that didn't work very hard on it, that this mantra will come up automatically, spontaneously in my mind. And I find that it's very reassuring, very supportive. And what it does is, it's sort of, mantra sometimes is called protection of the mind. It protects the mind so that the mind is, there's something the mind is engaged with. The mind is not freaking out or having to jump out of the bus or whatever it is. Yeah. So it protects the mind from extreme fear. So that illustrates to me the value of refuge. That at times of great difficulty, what I entrust myself to come back to support me. And I think that is, I find very, I really appreciate that very much. You know, I feel very grateful that I have such refuge that will support me at my times of great need. So I also hope that other people find their refuge. Because otherwise, can you imagine a person, a mind and heart that are suddenly, you know, find itself in a really difficult situation, a dangerous situation, a very painful situation. And yet there is no refuge, no safe haven in which you can retreat to or you can be in touch with that will protect you. And at least you feel safe, at least you can find like you're lost. In fact, there is a few image the Buddha used. If you are swept along a huge river, it would be really nice to find an island that you can crawl onto, get out of the water. Or you are lost at sea, it's really nice for your ship to be able to come into harbor. You know. So these are images the Buddha used of finding safety, finding refuge. And in daily life, there are occasions where we find ourselves in really difficult situations. You know, we are overwhelmed with fear and anxiety. We find ourselves fighting against depression and all sorts of very unpleasant, very really miserable kind of experiences. But in the midst of it, how wonderful it is if you know of something or somewhere or someone that you can come back to, and that can provide some kind of sense of safety, at least a respite away from all the turmoil of your daily life. And because of my job and what I've been doing, so I get to hear quite a lot of stories. You know, I have friends who are going through a really difficult, have gone through a really difficult divorce. It was very, very stressful emotionally and financially in many ways, right? And so in the midst of it, even just to preserve sanity, it's not so much about winning the court case or just to survive that period emotionally and mentally. You know, she relied on come back to her Dharma practice. In that case, this happened to be practice of Tara also. You know, she come back to try to do Tara practice every day, you know, recite the mantra. And that ritual, it's a ritualistic kind of practice, becomes like a little bit of sanity, you know, in a situation which is completely insane. Yeah. She's, at one point she's financially so difficult that she says, we go for a meal, she says, let me pay with my credit card and you guys pay me with cash. She's so, no cash at all. You know, yeah, so how difficult that is because of this whole divorce case, yeah. Right, so I hope that, you know, over these few weeks when we look at refuge, I hope you don't think of it too much of an intellectual way, Actually, refuge has a very practical importance to it. That it is really the whole aspect, the whole idea of talking about refuge and trying to experience refuge for ourselves is to find that that object of refuge that you can entrust yourself to, and that you can derive strength and protection and help and safety and security from, right? Especially when you really need it. Okay? Right. So last week I talked about the Buddha in my sort of my bizarre way of conceptualizing the Buddha. I present two ways of looking at the Buddha, because different people understand and relate to the whole idea of Buddha very differently, or Buddha, Buddhas differently. Yeah. So I give you two options, but there are many, many other ways. In fact, I think every individual Buddhist probably have his or her own idea of who or what is a Buddha, right? So I talk about one version, one way people can, or at least personally how I view the Buddha, is to see the Buddha in a very humanistic way. A fellow human being, although living like 2,500 years ago, who come upon through his own efforts and practice, experience what we call enlightenment. And I will talk more about this today. And through that transformation comes to find freedom from suffering and the causes of suffering, comes to find a genuine happiness for himself. And he set out for the rest of his life to teach that to others, to show others the way, how they others can also be enlightened. And so that is his mission in life. And so now that he has passed away, so I usually call this the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha. So, and he becomes like a model. And you can see him as the path finder. And it's quite often, there's a verse that says the Buddha, the way the Buddha helped us is not by transferring his realization into our mind. He can sort of drop it into our mind. Instead, the Buddha can only show us the way. And we ourselves have to walk the path. We have to kind of follow his example and figure it out for ourselves. Yeah. So I thought, then the other version, I talked about it, I was always jokingly referring to the cosmic jelly version of enlightenment of Buddha, of how, especially in the Mahayana tradition of Buddhism, we talk about the three bodies of Buddha, or sometimes we call it the three kayas, kayas in Sanskrit. Three kayas of the Buddha. Three ways in which enlightenment may be embodied, you know. And the most, it's like you take those jelly powder, and you dissolve it in hot water. Right? So the jelly is, gelatin basically, it permeates all of the water. It's all pervasive, right? But it doesn't have a specific form, right? Then when you pour it into the bowl, you allow it to cool down to room temperature, it starts to solidify, so it has a subtle form, a form that is conforming to the mold that you are using, the shape, you know, the mold. And then you put it in the fridge, and let's say you have this one has a high gelatin content, so when it solidifies completely, you take it out, you can remove the jelly from the mold. Not all jelly can be removed from the mold, unless you use agar-agar. So you took it out. Then you say, oh, you have an independent, self-standing, lump of jelly, right? Whichever shape you created in, right? So there's the three states, you know, three versions of it. So enlightenment can be visualized and understood in three different forms. Right? The last one, where it has this sort of complete form by itself, that's what we are most familiar with, like the Buddha that walked on the surface of the earth and any other enlightened being after him. You know, they have a human form. No, they are the physical embodiment of enlightenment with all the wonderful qualities within themselves. And these are the forms that's most obvious, and we can come into contact with them, we can have a conversation with them, they can inspire us, they can advise us. So this is the one that's most accessible to all of us. The second one, the one, the subtle form of jelly in the mold, require very special condition before we can connect with them. And they are more ethereal, no, more subtle. So you can understand it as when someone's mind is really pure. You know, they, within the mind itself, they can connect with enlightenment in some form. Right? So it's like a visionary experience that they don't call it hallucination, okay? But that they appear just in the person's mind and can have a conversation with the person, can receive teaching from them. You know? So this is sometimes called the enjoyment body or the Sambhogakaya of the Buddha. If you ever have a chance to come across this, it's quite a rare book called The Secret Visions of the Fifth Dalai Lama. It's a huge big book. And there actually is, I think it's a photographic image of a Tibetan text, a very unusual text. Text that is black in color with golden, the wordings are all in gold. Yeah. And it records, it's actually a record of the different visions the Fifth Dalai Lama received in his entire life. He has an amazing life. Even very young, he has spontaneously, he might be sitting with all the monks in the puja, right? And everybody is just chanting and looking at the statue. He has a different experience altogether. He has an image of Padmasambhava appearing in the space, giving him teaching, giving him initiation. And nobody around him knows about this secret experience, secret vision. Yeah. So when I read it, I thought, wow, my God, this is right. I think he's completely mad. Everyone is continuous hallucination throughout his entire life. But he isn't. The Fifth Dalai Lama is a very important political figure also in the history of Tibet. He's very much together. So he has these other experiences, which is private to him. And that way of contacting an enlightened being, you can think of that as the Sambhogakaya, the enjoyment body form of enlightenment. And this one is not accessible to everybody. It's only to certain people under certain conditions. Usually when the mind is very clear, very pure, and within that space of the mind, all these interesting things appear, right? And then the final or the first version, sometimes called the Dhammakaya, or the truth body of the Buddha, is said to be all pervasive, everywhere. Enlightenment and the enlightened being is literally everywhere. Although we currently are not able to access it, we are not able to be in touch with it, but nonetheless it's available. Yeah. So that is another way of looking at enlightenment. It's no longer very personal, no longer bound up with a human body, a human being, but the wonderful thing about it is that it makes it, it sort of transcends there's something that happened to a human being, but it's something universal. And it's readily available if the conditions were right. So these are the two different kind of way of understanding Buddha, enlightenment. Yeah. And I'm sure there are other ways. And I just want to add to it is, but what about when we pray to the Buddha? We stand in front of a statue and then we offer incense or flowers or fruit. And then sometimes at time of great difficulties, we pray for relief from pain, for recovery from illness, or to have a good rebirth, or to overcome some obstacles. So what sort of relationship we are engaging in with the Buddha when we engage in those kind of prayers? Although we do that, Buddhists do that all the time, although some people have this idea that Buddhists do not pray. Because the Buddha isn't a god, right? Actually, Buddhists are like human beings. Right? We pray all the time. We pray for all sorts of things. You know? Pray for a good job. Pray for a pay rise. We pray for things that we feel will help us to be happier. Yeah? But the main difference is that in Buddhism, the Buddhas are not creator of the universe. The Buddha doesn't create. Buddhas are not creator of us. So Buddhas are not like all powerful and control everything. So Buddhas, in fact, are almost like they discover, they realize reality, they realize truth, and through that realization, allow them to dispel some fundamental misunderstanding or ignorance that drive our common delusions, which are the source of our anguish and suffering. So Buddhas are, in that sense, awakened from the dream of delusion. So that's why the word Buddha actually has the root means to wake up, to be awakened. Yeah. But nonetheless, we can enter into a relationship with the Buddha because this awakened beings, these enlightened beings can serve as conditions. You know, they serve as conditions for us to create virtuous actions, wholesome actions that are conducive for our own happiness. So for example, when the Buddha, historical Buddha, was alive, you know, people can come to see him, people can show respect to him, can bow to him, during the morning, they can offer food into his arms bowl when he was called out begging, yeah. And those activities that people do in relation to him are sources for them to create virtues, you know, because they do it out of respect, out of generosity, you know, and especially if they come and attend his talk or come to seek his advice. So those interactions with the Buddha become conditions for those people to find happiness. So those are virtuous actions. So this idea of the Buddha as a condition for us to create positive actions, virtuous actions, is sometimes described as the Buddha are the field of merit. Field is like, you know, the land that you can, depending on fertile land, you can plant seeds, you can irrigate it, you can weed it, and as a result, you get the harvest. You can harvest the crops that is beneficial for yourself. Right? So the Buddha is, that's why it's called the field of merit. Because in relation to the Buddha, you can plant the seeds of meritorious actions, like virtuous actions. And over time, when it ripens, when the crops ripen, you reap the benefit of your own happiness, your own spiritual progress, deepening understanding, and, you know, and happiness. Yeah. So that's how, as a Buddhist, we can understand our relationship with the Buddha in this other way. You know? So all the interactions we have with the Buddha, of course now, you know, the historical Buddha is no longer physically present, but nonetheless we have representations like statues, tankas, you know, the huge big one that ABC put up during Visa, you know, the ginormous one. Yeah. So these are representations of the Buddha, the enlightened being. And in relation to them, we can still continue engage in virtuous action. So they are still around, available, as field of merit for us. Okay? And so it is, in this way, you can understand when we engage in making offering, we prostrate to them, or we recite prayers to them, that we are not so much like trying to gain favor from the Buddha, no, I treat you so well, right? Last time I buy you this really expensive chocolate, you know, you must also pay me back. It's not like a kind of transaction like that, but it's that because we practice virtue in relation to the Buddha, we recite prayers, we dedicate, then as a result of that virtuous action, something positive, something good come out of it. So my teacher used to like to talk of the statues, images, and this also includes like the big prayer wheel. No, yeah. These are objects, holy objects that provide powerful conditions. You know, that if we make good use of them, we can create happiness for ourselves or for others as well. And so they are conditions for us to engage with, interact with, that will provide some causes of happiness. Okay. So it's a little bit different from a theistic religion in which when we pray to God or to the Creator, that relationship is a bit different the way we understand it. Although most students, they don't really make any difference. Because the important thing is not the underlying philosophy. I get what I want. So that's why I joke, right? You go to Waterloo, Kuan Yin Temple, and then you come up and you go to a Hindu temple, and then you go to wherever. No, you just spread out, diversify your investments, you know, lower your risk, and don't put all your eggs in one basket. And the main thing is to get what you want, right? You know, you want a good relationship, or go and just do it whichever way you can get it. Yeah. Okay, so that is a little bit about the Buddha. Just to conclude what I started last. So, any question about that? About the Buddha object refuge? Okay, anyway, let me continue. So today I want to talk about the second object of refuge. There are three in Buddhism, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. or Sanskrit word. So the Buddha is the awakened one, the enlightened being. The Dharma is, the word Dharma is a complicated word, but here it refers to teaching. But you can understand in two different ways. One is sometimes called the scriptural Dharma. Another one is called realizational Dharma. So basically, scriptures means information. What is recorded down on paper, what is in all sorts of other media, the information that we receive when we attend a talk like this, or we read a book, or we read one of the discourses, the sutras. But that's the intellectual knowledge and information. The other one, the realization of Dharma, is not just information, it's the actual transformation we see within ourselves. Actual realization. Something has changed, something has shifted within ourselves. So we have realized, we have made real something. So that, those changes, or what we call realization, is another way of understanding the word Dharma. Among the two, of course, the realizations are, we would say, would be the true Dharma refuge. Because through those transformations, through those realizations, it really transforms the way we see things. We have a profound shift in our perspective. We let go of some of our deluded ideas, our ignorant way of understanding things. So we let go of that and we acquire a very different perspective, more enlightened perspective. And in the light of that, we actually see things clearer and we respond to them more appropriately. And therefore we are actually happier. Something that used to create a lot of suffering or anguish in us no longer has that effect anymore. But these days we always talk about people pressing our buttons, right? Pressing our buttons. So when you have a realization, you remove the button. No. So there is no button to press. No matter what they do, that button doesn't exist anymore. And they are no longer able to trigger old way of reacting, especially old, very harmful way of reacting. They're not there anymore. It's gone. So imagine you remove all the buttons. What other people do? Fun, no? I'm happy. You're not happy, that's fine, but I'm still happy. I'm still at peace. I'm still free and liberated. Yeah. So realization is the real thing. The thing that, where you take away the buttons of reactivity. So you no longer need to react like that. You have a better way of responding to what's happening in your life. Okay, so and that's the real deal. We will come back to it. But we all start with the scriptural Dharma. Because that's where we learn about the Buddha. We learn a little bit of what he discovered during his enlightenment and what he has been teaching. And we try to make sense of it in our head. What does it mean? What is it talking about? What is Buddhism all about? So we have all the information. So we acquire knowledge about intellectual. Because it takes a while for it to become actual experience. But even those knowledge, those information, are part of Dharma and can also be very helpful. Because a lot of times, a lot of our trouble or problems come from maybe a lack of correct knowledge, or we have a lot of misinformation or misunderstanding. So just having, even just in words or concepts, a different idea or more information, that in itself can be very helpful. But I personally find things to do with death. Right? And Buddhism, if you study Buddhism, you never escape from information about death. It's one of the favorite topics that Buddhists teacher like to talk about. You must be aware of them, all these things. So even if you don't do anything else, you just come for a talk, right? You will be exposed to the topic of death. Death and impermanence. Death and impermanence. You're going to die. Don't think that you're not going to die. Everybody's going to die. You don't know when you're going to die. No one's going to help you enough. So even you are completely like when you're in, when you're out, you still, unfortunately, will be exposed to the topic of death a lot. And I find it quite interesting, because it's so it becomes less of a taboo. And when I do in my life encounter loss, a loss of loved one, close one, it's still difficult, it's still grief, but it's not unexpected. After all, since day one, been reminded that there's such a thing called death. You don't think that you will be able to avoid it. So when it actually arrives in my life, you say, well, of course, you know, I've been warned about it, you know, again and again in the teaching. So the whole experience or encounter with death, although still unpleasant, is not a surprise. It's not a shock. It's almost like an affirmation of the truth of what I have been studying and learning about. And that, I think, gives a lot of support to me, even though I go through grief. And it's quite amazing. I actually find that I'm really very grateful for those teachings on death and impermanence, because other people, for one reason or another, can react very strongly to death. You know, the grief can come very strong and very persistent. You know, it's almost like death is... we try so hard to keep it out of our awareness that when it finally erupts into our awareness, we find it very unbearable. Find very hard, we don't know how to relate to it, don't know how to deal with it. Yeah. So it helps to be, maybe it's like desensitization process, this exposed progressively to it, that when it actually happens, it's although difficult, but it's not like tragic. Yeah. Okay. So that's how even scriptural dharma, even just learning more, having more information, having more knowledge, you know, about even on the intellectual level, can be very helpful. And also it gives you more options, because you can learn to think differently about topic. You are exposed to more ideas, more alternatives, and so you are not so stuck in just one way of thinking. You will find that you have alternatives. You can have, you can rely on other things to support you. Okay? So even scriptural dharma is very important, which is why studying, you know, coming to talks like this, you know, reading up, you know, about this day, there's so many information, you know, watch some YouTube videos, you know, there's a wealth of information about the Dharma, which is so amazing. It's a long time, you ask, you know, you just go back a few decades. It's not like this. In certain countries, especially in English medium, the Dharma is very not available, right? And so there are stories that my teacher, Rambha Sangyakadro, told that she was traveling in Germany. She was teaching in Germany at one point. And this old gentleman, I think, came up to her to relate to her his life story of how he'd been old back then. Means, you know, he encountered Buddhism very early in life, but at that time there's no Buddhism in Germany, in Europe, right? Or it's very, very inaccessible. He encountered a statue of the Buddha, a small statue of Buddha. He was very drawn to the image. You know, there's something resonate very strongly. And he was very curious. This is probably pre-war, one of the war, I don't know, World War One or World War Two, right? So he encountered the image, and he really wants to find more about this image. The image speaks to him, you know, maybe more so than his own traditional Christian background. And he really wants to find more about it. He felt that there is something here related to that image, the Buddha image, that is what he wants, that he needs. But he is not, that wish will not be fulfilled until, like, maybe when, you know, back then when he was talking to my teacher, he's probably in his 70s or 80s. Many, many, many years later, you know, when Buddhism become more available, when the Dharma become available, that is only fulfilled at that time. So there was a gap of tens of several decades. So that goes to show sometimes that the fact that we now have access to so much of the information of the Dharma, so readily available in so many different forms from so many different traditions, such a wonderful thing. And just by learning about them, just by acquainting ourselves with what we call scriptural dharma, and speaking as a Buddhist, I think it's in itself very fortunate, very beneficial, and can, even at that level, can be an object of refuge for us. Yeah. But the main thing about refuge of Dharma is the realization of Dharma. It's when information or intellectual knowledge transform into actual experience, actual shift in perspective, actual change of heart. That, I would say, is true refuge. Because then that is real protection of the mind and heart. That what previously may still be able to disturb you or hurt you or harm you, and now deprived of that power, they no longer have that kind of effect on you. Because you found something different, you see things differently, and therefore you no longer fall back into those old habits, and those old ways of reacting. They are creating trouble for yourself and others. And in a way, that's why we say we are liberated. That's why another word for quite often in Buddhism, we talk about the goal as another word for enlightenment is liberation. Liberation from the causes of suffering. You know, things that have been constraining you, things that have been causing a lot of anguish for you. So you are liberated from that. Okay. Sounds all right? Yeah. Wouldn't it be nice to have a realization, don't you think? Yeah, although I have very low standard, okay? I always tell people the secret of happiness is to start from a lower standard, right? I do have low standard, but my low standard is not like no standard, okay? I really think that no matter how low your standard is, sometimes your but low but good quality standard, you should aim for one realization in this life, okay? Don't try and tell me, don't try to be modest and say, oh yeah, I can never have a realization. People like me will never have a realization. And then what's the point of studying that? No. So I think even though you may start from a low standard, you should aim a bit higher. Aim to realize something. Make real something within your own experience. Make real part of the, any part of the Buddha's teaching has some kind of real understanding, real transformation, real shift in perspective. Okay. So in line with that, I like to explain this realization that always sounds very mysterious. Right? Only holy people can know. All those are not holy people never have realization. If I tell you I've realized, don't you? You don't believe me. Don't look holy enough. So cannot possibly have realization. All those holy ones. In Tibetan tradition, look like Chinese, but actually Tibetan, a bit darker skin, and a strange hairstyle, and wear funny, just a cloth around, you know, usually red in color, Or if you are lay people, there's this, I was trying to persuade my friend to get this, it's called a Nakpa rope, which is actually, white in color, but it has bands of maroon, and it actually symbolizes a lay practitioner of Tantra, actually. I said, it will look nice on you. Try to buy one. Maybe just by wrapping it around yourself with the aircon on, of course, in Singapore. You might actually get, something may rub off and you get a realization. So you must at least look the part, to be realized. Then if you have long hair, you coil it up into a turban, top knot. So then, maybe then people will believe that you have a realization. But actually, realization is not so rare, not so difficult, not so complicated. If you understand a realization as a shift, a profound shift in perspective, okay? So like normally in life, we look at things from a particular way. And so we see things like that, and also things appear to us like that. Yeah? And therefore, we react to it. We do things, we talk, we act, or don't act, all in line with that. And realization is not like becoming something special, someone special. Realization means you have an alternative. Suddenly there's another point of view. You can look at the person, you can look at the situation from another angle. Something a bit apart. Then now when you're stuck in this way, you can adopt this other perspective. You can see, hey, actually, there are other options. There are other ways of understanding. I can also feel differently and act differently. So a shift in perspective. In what we call mind-only school of Buddhist philosophy, which is There are many different schools or sects among Buddhist philosophy. One of them is called Mind-Only School. They have a phrase, a very nice phrase, to describe realization. Realization is turning to the seat of consciousness. So seat, right? So you imagine consciousness sitting on the seat. Right? No one of those modern office chairs, you know, with wheels and different. Right? So turning at the seat is that actually your seat turns. And therefore, what happens? You have a different view, isn't it? You know, if you are in the normal old-fashioned chair, you sit like this and the chair face like this, you're stuck in one view. Right? Now you have modernized, right? Your seat can swerve. If you swerve, a different scene appears in front of you. Right? Turning at the seat of consciousness means your consciousness is liberated from the old way of seeing things and experiencing things. And that change is fundamental. Start all the way down at the very root of the seat. And the seat turns 180 degrees. Voila! Ta-da! A different view appears, different scenery. Said, oh, I didn't realize I can see things like that. I didn't realize things can appear and so different from a very different angle. And that is how I understand realization. Nothing very sophisticated, nothing very difficult. You just need to swivel your chair, right? That is the difficult part. Right? Because usually we are very stuck. In fact, there is a phrase called tunnel vision. Right? You feel like your life is in a tunnel. Right? And tunnel only has two ends, right? And no other alternatives, right? So quite often we find ourselves in a tunnel. We find ourselves like, oh, either I go forward or I go backward, or I'm stuck in the middle. There's no other alternative. Life seems to be enclosed in the tunnel. Right? And that tunnel actually is constructed by past experiences, past conditioning, experience constructed by your thoughts, the way you think about things, right? In a very kind of limited way. And sometimes other people put you inside the tunnel and keep you there. They'll tell you that it's a toxic emotional bad meal. If you love me, you will do what I ask you to do. And if you don't agree, you don't love me. Two options, right? Either this way or that way. Right? Actually, not too right. You can love them and don't agree with them. And don't do what they ask, isn't it? So the tunnel is sometimes constructed by ourselves, by our upbringing, by our background, by our ideas. Sometimes also constructed by people around us. People want you to stay inside the tunnel. And realization is to realize that actually there is never a tunnel in the first place. It's wide open space. You can go like this, go like that, go like this. There's many, many other possibilities, many, many other ways, and many other options available. Your mind becomes very flexible, very open, very flexible, very receptive. And as opposed to when you are in a tunnel, it's very rigid, very inflexible, very limited. Okay. So there's another image for realization. Realization is simply stepping out of your tunnel vision and discover many, many more possibilities. Okay. So if you think in terms of that way, then you realize that actually it's not so impossible for us, not so impossible for us to gain realization. Because some of us, actually, we might have, mini realizations, okay? Well, the easy one is to do with impermanent change, right? Previously, maybe, we know intellectually, we know about impermanence or change, but we are still quite fixated on things. Right? As the passing of time, as we age, we find that what previously we find very hard to let go, previously things that we feel must stay the same. As we age, we are more wiser. We understand impermanence. We expect things to change. And we are a bit more graceful in that acceptance. So there is a little bit of shift in our perspective. Already. So that is a mini realization. You just need a big one. A big, profound, deep-seated shift in perspective. And that is the one that we talk about quite often as a enlightenment experience or awakening experience. I don't know whether you have heard of terms like this in spiritual circles, not just Buddhists, but in like Hindus and others, New Age and so on. People talk about how they have an awakening experience, they have an enlightenment experience, something which they regard as transformative. Right? In fact, I have a friend who's off to Europe to have an enlightenment experience, drug-induced. He's going to go to Amsterdam to pick a particular drug. I think it's called DMT. I think I'm going to look it up there. It's some kind of psychedelic drug to open the door of perception and to have an enlightenment experience. So when he came back, I will ask him, so how is enlightenment? People do. That's why I thought to talk a little bit about this enlightenment experience, awakening experience, in the context of the refuge of Dharma, because you might have heard about it, even in the Buddhist context, or in some other spiritual context, and it might be a good, interesting thing to talk about. What exactly is it? You know, is there such a thing as, can you have a false awakening experience? No. And what to make about it? Anybody heard of, have you heard of awakening experience? Have you had an awakening experience? There are, according to the teaching, there are some kind of experiences, very special experiences that we can have, but they are not awakening experiences, they are not enlightenment experiences. In a sense, they are not profound shift in perspective. They are just very special experiences. A common one usually is experiences of bliss, very, very blissful, but wow, bliss, experience of clarity. Sometimes people say, wow, my mind is so clear. Maybe drug induced. I can see the molecules in the carpet. No? Like there's this sense of intense clarity of the mind, like the mind becomes like so powerful, wow, clarity. And the third one is, no thought. Mind is so quiet, not a single thought, nothing disturbed. Wow, I must be enlightened. This tree, or in any combination, sometimes people call it corruption of insight. They are special experiences, but they are not, unfortunately, not quite enlightened yet. Right? So you can have, usually in the context of meditation, but sometimes spontaneously people can have experience of bliss, experience of great clarity of mind, experiences of no thought, complete stillness of the mind. Just this tree alone is not qualified as an awakening experience from the Buddhist perspective. They are wonderful experience, it's wonderful to have them. They might help you, they may sort of encourage you to meditate more, to go deeper, to explore more. So they are wonderful experience. But by themselves alone, they make you feel very special. They're so unusual experience. But they are not quite what we call enlightenment or awakening. Because if you look at them carefully, they are what we call conditional experiences. They arise because of certain conditions, maybe because you took a drug, maybe because it so happened that your meditation arrive at the place where it stimulates these experiences to arise. But they are not transformative in the sense that they don't imply any deep-seated change in your perspective. Right? So you can experience great bliss. You can discover how powerful the mind is. The mind can actually be so clear and so powerful and so like logical, whatever. And the mind can actually function without thought. With all this blah 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 blah, and now, oh, now is the time to watch the breath. Oh, I must come back. I must do this. All this chattering of the mind, that can completely stop, and your mind can still function. Right. So very unusual experiences, but not quite enlightenment awakening experience. I'll stand it a little bit higher, not so low. Okay. But because they are so unusual, a lot of people are captivated by them. And so when you encounter them in your own experience, it's very difficult for you to believe that you're still not it. You're still not enlightened. Yeah. I used to joke because when I was working in Sydney in the Buddhist Center, once we received an email, an actual email that said, I'm already enlightened. What should I do next? Then me and the administrator, we say, what can we say, you know? How can we reply seriously to this email, you know? Because if you are enlightened, you are awakened, surely you would have that clarity of mind to understand what to do next, right? So it's possible for someone like that, maybe they have a very unusual experience, really wonderful experience, you know, but bliss or clarity or no thoughts or a combination of them. But you can see that this experience, although very special, do not confer upon you a change in your understanding, a change in your perspective of how you see understanding life or life circumstances. So they are not necessary. They're not wisdom. They're not deepening of wisdom. They're just very fantastic kind of experiences, usually arising in the context of meditation. Okay. Then there are other type of experiences which are, now I cannot comment, I can't say whether they are enlightened or not. People experience, sometimes in meditation, sometimes out of meditation, suddenly a deep sense of connection with everything in the universe. Usually this kind of experience, I call them non-dual experience. Non-dual, not two, because usually involve a loss of a sense of self. Normally, we have this sense, I'm here, and the cup is there. Yeah. Subject, object. Or in meditation, people have this sense that I'm the meditator, and I'm watching the breath. So the breath is the object, and I'm the meditator watching the breath. And sometimes, this develops into what we call witness. You know, you can witness the breath, you can witness the thought coming and going. But there's always two things. There's the witness, the observer, and there's the object, the observed. So it's a dualistic experience, as we say. A non-dual experience is very hard to describe in words, because words and language are dualistic. A non-dual experience is suddenly you have, you know, you can try to imagine that there's not two things. You know. They don't have a witness, they have an observer, and almost like the observer and the observed somehow merged into one, become one. How bizarre that is, right? There's a sense, loss of a sense of self. A self, loss of an agent participating in. You know, sometimes people describe it as, how strange, you know, things just happen, and I don't have to do anything about it. The breath just come and go, thoughts arise and pass, things just happen, but I'm not there. So these are non-dual experiences. Okay, this is another category of spiritual experiences that sometimes people may have in meditation or out of meditation, and they come closer to enlightenment or awakening, right? Because enlightenment and awakening involve one of the shifts in perspective is to realize that there is no such thing as a permanent, unchanging, independent self here. Right? Actually, it is empty of such a self. What in Buddhism we call emptiness and selflessness. So some of these experiences are very similar to what we learn in the teaching about emptiness and selflessness. The only thing I cannot say is, although you may have the experience, have you realized it? That's the other thing. Have you realized the true meaning, the true significance of that experience? Yeah. So then that is difficult for me to say. I can't say it yet. So I thought to talk a little bit about this kind of unusual experiences people may have within a spiritual context or within a Buddhist context, just to show you that when we talk about realization dharma, realization of having an actual experience and realization, it's quite easy to be confused about it, to be unclear whether what I experience is that a realization or is it not. This is the time when it's helpful to talk to a spiritual teacher, you know, to seek some clarification and verification to see whether your understanding of your experience is in line with the teaching or not. So that would be very helpful. Okay. Yeah. So you're saying, okay, first question is, suppose you're out on the street and you have this experience where you feel that you yourself is in the center of mandala and everything around is just part of your mandala, the people, the building, everything is a part of it. So does this qualify as a non-dual experience? That's the question. Well, based on my limited understanding, it looks very dualistic, isn't it? There is a center, and you feel that you are in the center, and that this is other things. They are part of your universe. Mandala, another word for the word mandala is the universe. So they populate your universe. Yeah. So that is a kind of experience. Maybe you can call it a spiritual experience. But I would say that it's not very non-dualistic, because there is still a very strong sense of you at the center. If you say that, oh, you see, everything is the mandala and there is nothing in the center, I'm actually everything in the mandala. If you say like that, I'm actually everything in the mandala. The building is me, the other people are me, and I'm the entire mandala. Everything in the mandala is me. Then I would say, oh, maybe that is non-dualistic. You understand what I'm saying? Yeah. Okay. So, but no, any experience is interesting. I'm always curious about experiences. So when you have an experience like this, you can, you know. So sometimes I suggest to people to keep a meditation journal. And in the journal, you write down your own experiences. You know? No matter, can be very mundane or can be very unusual. You try to describe it as accurately as possible. First describe it, then if you want to interpret it, you can interpret it. So as you describe it, it helps you to, even though it's after the event, helps you to be mindful of the details and help you to recollect what actually happened to me in the experience. And maybe not immediately, but you know, maybe weeks, months, and then years later, if you come back to the record, you can have your own insight into what actually happened at that moment. So first question. Second question? So if you, someone come to a, let's say a meditation course, and you suspect that there are some challenges, they may have suffering from some mental illnesses, whether is it recommend to ask them to continue meditation, or if not, what other schizophrenia? My experience is because I don't screen people, you know, I don't give them forms and things like that. But also I take certain precautions when I present meditation. My style is not very, I tell them they can do whatever they want, or they can just ignore what I say in my meditation. So what I'm trying to do is I try not to make it like a pressure cooker. I make sure that the conditions I provide when I facilitate meditation allow them to have many different options. And I sometimes even emphasize that if they don't feel comfortable, or something unpleasant happened, there are also many options for them. You know, they can terminate the meditation, they can have a break, they can walk out if they want, or they can just lie down and have a nap. Right? So that is the first precaution because of the context I do, is to allow people lots of options and to make it clear to them that there are many things they can do to keep themselves safe. Right? Okay? But if they were to talk to me about meditation, and if they were to tell me they are suffering from hallucinations, or some of which, especially if they find hallucination triggered by the meditation they are doing, I will be very explicit to them and will say that meditation is not advisable for, you know, if you find that that is what you are facing. This also extends to people who are suffering from depression or suffering from anxiety. If they talk to me, I will explain to them meditation is not always the best thing if you are going through a depression episode, if you are in the midst of in the middle of a depression episode. You're experiencing very strongly the symptoms of depression, or you're experiencing very strongly the symptoms of anxiety. I will explain to them, meditation is not what is usually, you know, talked about in popular press, that it can have some very unfortunate side effects, because it draws too much of your attention inward, and maybe in when you're in certain conditions, that is not the most advisable thing to do. Okay? In fact, I always try them, try exercise. Because try or some kind of movement thing that can also help you develop mindfulness and awareness, but doesn't keep your body still, doesn't kind of ask you to, you know, bring your attention all inwards. Yeah. Because when you exercise or you engage in some kind of movement thing, it forces your attention to also be aware of your surrounding, be aware of your body, especially with your body. And I think that is actually much more helpful for them. Yeah. Example about what? The tunnel vision. Yeah. Okay. So the question is, even though you agree that no movement and things like that, but it's very hard to facilitate them to be unstuck from their own condition. I suggest you leave it to them. No, don't try to unstuck them. Because what happens is, if they're not ready, if they come unstuck, it can be a very traumatic experience for them. Because being stuck means it's something they are, it's not nice, but it's something familiar to them. You know, there is a certain kind of distorted logic and order to our delusions. Yeah. And if someone is not ready to come unstuck, to be forcefully unstuck from their delusions, can be a very traumatic experience for them. Right? So unless they are under close supervision with a professional like a therapist, and they are able to gradually come unstuck, and also when they do feel it's too much, there is a margin of, there is a kind of safety they can come back to, and they know how to do that. Becoming unstuck in itself can be a difficult transition. So I don't have a savior complex. I don't try to save anybody. You are stuck, you're stuck from this. So, I mean, although I empathize with you, I don't feel that I'm necessarily the person or I have the means to unstuck you. But of course, if you come unstuck, I will try to support you, but I don't want to be the one that go and unstuck you. You know what I'm trying to say? Because I think that requires clarity in the relationship you have with this person. And usually I do drop-in sessions, right? They come and go. I know their face, but I don't know their name. I don't know anything about them. And that kind of circumstances, that kind of action is not justified. Right? Although I feel that I can see, or maybe this person is stuck, and I would like them to be unstuck, to be free from their suffering. Certain kind of activities, certain kind of actions require a different type of basis, a different kind of relationship, different kind of commitment. So if they are with let's say someone, a professional like a therapist, and they establish a kind of commitment to that relationship, and then in that situation, coming unstuck may be the goal of therapy. Yeah. But other than that, or if it's like say a traditional like a guru student relationship, spiritual teacher and a spiritual seeker, and they are in a context, let's say they are on a meditation retreat. No, and the teacher is trying to help student to overcome some obstacles. In that kind of context, then maybe it's justified. But there must be clarity of that relationship before we try to do anything with anybody. It's a very difficult one, unstuck people. It's a difficult one. Wait. So senior citizens with dementia, they're not stuck, you know. They're like, That is symptoms of dementia, so people with dementia sometimes exhibit challenging behavior, right, which is their way of managing their anxiety or their confusion and frustration. And so people who are trained to work with people with dementia learn how to manage challenging behaviors. You understand that they are suffering from the conditions of dementia. So it's no point reasoning with them, or no point yelling at them and telling them, don't forget, no, I already told you 10 times, you must remember it next time. So in fact, you try to accommodate their limitations and their difficulties and try to find a way to communicate with them or try to understand where they're coming from. Yeah. But I wouldn't consider that stuck, right? Because, you know, the brain cells are dying. What do you expect people to do, right? I used to have a conversation with my father, maybe pass on now. He has mild cognitive impairment. And it manifests in the sense that his short-term memory is completely unreliable. Okay? So I asked him, Dad, what do you eat for lunch? He will tell me something. But I think it has nothing to do with reality, right? About lunch, whether you go to the toilet or not, but anything that has to do with short-term memory is unreliable. Because I never know what's actually gone. But I still have those conversations with him. But the aim is not information gathering. Information, I go and ask the nurse. I go and ask the staff. But that conversation is for connection. Just to have something to talk about. You know? So it's kind of a very bizarre conversation. It took me a while to kind of work it out. Is that you can have conversation with someone in which almost nothing about it is facts. It's just blah, blah, blah. But it's quite fun. Yeah. And then, and I think it serves a very positive purpose. Yeah. Yeah. But she, although it is a bit confusing, but is she happy then? Is she participate? But the thing is that, you know, like, it's a bit like us sometimes, we get stuck in certain way of thinking. Yeah, so in her case, maybe for some reason, she gets stuck in thinking that it's a temper she's going to run. And so she couldn't work out, she couldn't reconcile the reality with the idea she had in her mind. Yeah. But I think, I mean, I'm no expert on dementia, but sometimes I think some mistakes are not necessary to be corrected, you know, because what's the point, right? I mean, if correcting the mistake creates more anguish and more disturbance, it doesn't make the purpose of that. Or maybe the temple is next door, like, this is the Buddha statue is outside. So I think sometimes with situation like this, we need to come from a compassionate place, you know. What can I say or what can I do that is most helpful, most beneficial for them, and not so much from a place of getting it right or getting it wrong. So a lot of time I notice people try to set things right. You know, that you didn't have jichong fun for lunch, you have chicken rice. You know, honestly, who cares whether you have chicken rice or jichong fun, right? No, so long as you eat, you are happy. Actually, I have a friend, she's lives in Australia. Her mother only eats cereal. No, she's quite elderly and suffering a little bit of dementia. And only cereal for breakfast, cereal for lunch, cereal for dinner. And she's quite alright. She says, so long as she eats something, as far as I'm concerned, mom can have cereal for all she wants. You know, can add different things in, try to have vitamins, try to have a balanced meal. But if cereal is all she will eat, then cereal it will be. Okay, don't need to, interesting thing is because it means you need to transcend very fixed ideas that we have, that we normal people have, that it should be like this, it should not be like that, and so on and so forth. Okay. Alright, so we have 15 minutes left, and I would like to do a meditation related to the Dharma record. And unfortunately, I cannot give you realization. Just like this, be wonderful, right? You try on realization and say, "Oh, I think this is really great. I will buy this home. Yeah, this will be my refuge." But I can't do it. But I think there's a way of we can try to approximate a little bit what it might be like to have a realization, and in meditation. So I thought we can just try this meditation on. Let me just explain. Normally when we meditate, we get very fixated on what we are meditating on. We are meditating on the breath, or meditating on loving kindness, or we meditate on the Buddha image, must get the Buddha image right. And then if it's not the Buddha image, then, distraction, so terrible, I must not be distracted. I must not fall asleep, that's the end of the world, I fall asleep and meditate. Actually, we do it all the time, huh? No big deal. So, another way of meditating is not so much to focus on the object, the breath, or loving kindness, or the Buddha image, but as you meditate, to meditate on the space of the mind, the space, physical space and also mental space, the space in which the breath moves in and out of your experience, the space in which you experience the bodily sensations, the space in which feelings come and go, the space in which thoughts come and go, space in which even images like the Buddha or some memories arise. So space is, this is not strictly emptiness or selflessness, but come closest to it. So I thought we can do a meditation on space and see whether we can be a bit more on, at least we're not in a tunnel. We are a little bit more. The tunnel is a bit wider, like MRT tunnel, right? Big one, and more space, although still in the tunnel, but you feel not so claustrophobic. Okay, so we let's meditate on space, just for a short time. Okay, so, let's start by just settling our body in a comfortable, supportive posture. I'll guide you through this, and normally I tell people, what I say during the meditation is just some recommendations or some help. And if you find that it's not helpful, you're most welcome to ignore me. Right. So just take a few moments, find a supportive posture for your body. Try to make sure that your back, your spine feels comfortable in this position. You don't have to consciously tense up the muscles of your back to straighten your spine. It's not really necessary. Instead, just trying to find a position that allows your spine, your back, to be upright in a natural way. You don't feel any strain in your back. It can be as comfortable as it can be. Rest your hands on your knees or one on top of the other. You can rest them in your lap in such a way that allows your shoulders to be relaxed. Usually, I suggest people to just close their eyes completely in meditation. And of course, you can also do it other ways. If you want to leave your eyes open a little or leave them open, that's entirely up to you. So take a few moments and allow your body to find its way into this meditation posture of yours. Really allow your body to feel that it is well supported, balanced, and safe in this posture. Given time, the body can slowly at its own pace start to loosen up a bit, unwind a bit, let go of some unnecessary tension, tightening, contraction. So that gradually you can settle down comfortably into this posture. the next step, we're going to take some time just to help body and mind to settle down into meditation. So a simple way is to take a few deep breaths. Let's place your attention on the breath. Now we start to breathe in and out deeply. And as you breathe out, remind yourself to release. Allow the breath to settle back to its natural rhythm. And for the first few minutes of the meditation, see if you can return your attention to the breath, to your natural breath, again and again. Not to be too worried or upset if your mind gets distracted elsewhere. Think that that is perfectly normal. And just gently invite your attention back to the breath, so that you can fully experience your in-breath and your out-breath. And pay special attention to your out-breath. Each time you feel yourself breathing out, remind yourself this is an excellent opportunity to release. As you breathe out, your body naturally releases carbon dioxide, the stale air in your lungs. Maybe some of the tension and tightness in the body can also go with the breath. And maybe some of the thoughts or memories or fantasies that preoccupy your mind, maybe some of them can also flow away with the breath. See if you can come back to the breath again and again at your own pace. And as you breathe out, allow yourself to deepen the sense of release. Release your body and your mind into your meditation. And then for the third step to deepen this meditation, we're going to meditate on space. We're going to become more aware of the space in our meditation. So first you can be aware of the physical space in which we breathe in and out. Breathing in, we draw air from outside into the space of our lungs. And breathing out, we release the air back into the vast outer space. So the breath happens within space. And likewise, when you notice sound of the ventilator, the aircon, sound of the traffic, sound reverberates in space also. When you come back to your meditation, come back to here and now, maybe come back to the breath. See if you can, again and again, become aware of the space within which the breath happens, the sounds happen, space within which you experience different bodily sensations, tension, relaxation, comfort, discomfort, all these things happen within the space of your mind, your awareness. Maybe by now you notice that your attention may be drawn to thoughts, inner speech, maybe some memories, some images may arise within the mind, drawing your attention towards them. See if you can, when you notice it, become aware. Notice that your thoughts, your memories, words and images somehow also appear or happen within the space of the mind. There are a lot of space around the thoughts, space around those images. So coming back to your meditation, coming back to the space of the mind, space of your awareness within which all these other things happen. The meditation can be a bit confusing if you're the first time you encounter. So just try your best. Maybe that space, the space of the mind and awareness, can be your refuge. A place where you can return your attention to again and again. And while you are aware of the space, other things can come and go. Sounds can rise and disappear. Thoughts can come and go. Sensations can happen and change. All within unchanging space. Okay, so that's just a short 15-minute meditation on space of the mind, space of awareness, or sometimes I call it aware space. And it's a meditation in which instead of placing your attention on a specific object, like the breath, or on specific images, specific thoughts, you actually notice the space in which all these things happen and come in and go. The meditation that I think can help you to come get an idea or come a bit closer to a realization, a shift in perspective. Yeah. So anyway, if I remember next week, we can explore it a little bit more, and then we can talk a bit more of how the Dharma, you know, especially in terms of realization, can be a support and refuge for us, especially during difficult times. Okay, so thank you very much for your attention, and see you next week.